the day. Welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail with Mark Amaru Pinkham. This program will explore the secrets behind the Knights Templar and other secret mysteries of the world today. Now here's your host, Mark Amaru Pinkham.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to another special edition of the Guardians of the Holy Grail, the program dedicated to diving deep to uncover and expose the truth behind the Knights Templar, the Holy Grail, secret societies, and many of the world's occult and esoteric mysteries. This show, the Guardians of the Holy Grail, was created by me to reveal the truth behind the secret societies, Holy Grail, mysteries, Gnosis, alchemy, and what has been branded as heretical movements. Now, through this show, I hope to set the record straight with hard facts from authors and researchers, as well as with testimonials from current and past members of various initiatic societies and orders. I myself am a Knight Templar of the International Order of Gnostic Templars. And some of you might have visited our site on occasion. We are at www.gnostictemplars.org. If you'd like to visit, you can sign our mailing list while you're there and receive our monthly e-newsletter. You can become an associate member of our organization if you'd like. And you can even download an application to become a full initiated member if you feel drawn to doing that. You'll find we have some videos you can watch on various Templar topics there. We also have books on sale, as well as some unique courses. Now, today, during our special program, if you'd like to call in at any time and ask a question for our guest, please use our toll-free number, which is 888-627-6008. And we look forward to all your questions and comments. Now, today we're going to be discussing a very mysterious island off the coast of Denmark. This island's been called the Secret Island of the Knights Templar. Some of you may have heard of it. The name of it is Bornholm. Now, our special guest today is Erling Haagensen, who's a native of the island. Erling is a musician, he's a journalist, he's a photographer, and he's a documentary maker. He's done many years of research on Bornholm, especially studying its 15 unique Gothic-style churches, which are believed to have been built by the Knights Templar. Now, some years ago, Erling compared notes with Henry Lincoln, one of the co-authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and at that time he found that the placement of many of the churches on Bornholm are in a very similar geometrical pattern as the landmarks and buildings in the Rennes-le-Château region in southern France that Henry Lincoln had been studying for years. Now, Erling and Henry Lincoln got together eventually, and they wrote a very fascinating book entitled The Templar's Secret Island, which I know you can get on Amazon. A very fascinating book, and a lot of my questions today will be coming from that book. Now, if you want to know more about our guest, he does have a website. It's M. Erling, MEARLING.DK, Merling.DK, and that's his website if you'd like to know more about him and his work and what he's up to. Very fascinating man. So, greetings, Erling, and welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail. Erling? Hello? Hello, Erling, are you there? I guess we lost him for a moment. Anyway, we're going to, during this interview, we're going to be talking about the Templar history on Bornholm. Why is it that the Templars chose this island in the Baltic Sea, rather, as a headquarters for their, you know, the Northern Empire? I mean, it just seems like a very strange place for them to go, and it's not a very big island. So, you know, what is the mystery behind this? And one of the very amazing mysteries is that the ley line configuration on Bornholm is nearly identical to that on in the Rennes-Château region, except it's reverse. In the Rennes-Château region, you have a upward-pointing pentagram, and on Bornholm, you've got a downward-pointing pentagram. Very amazing. So obviously, there does seem to be some kind of esoteric connection that unites the two islands, and or the two areas, rather. And this is what we're going to be exploring today by probably the best authority we can find, someone that actually lives right there on the island. And I'm particularly curious because I am a Templar, and of course, there's many different legends of Templar gold, Templar treasures, documents, whatever, that were hidden during the latter days of the Templars. And of course, many of them, we believe, ended up in the Rennes-Château region. And apparently, there is a lot of speculation that they also ended up on the island of Bornholm. And I'm not sure about this, but I assume that there's probably a lot of researchers and Templars that have gone up there seeing what they can find. I think we have Erling back finally. Are you on the line, Erling?
Right, I am here. I'm here, Mark.
Excellent, excellent, great. Well, welcome to our show today. It's definitely a pleasure and honor to have you on.
Thank you so much. I'm so pleased.
Well, you grew up on Bornholm, and so when is it that you first realized that you were living on a place that was really special?
Well, I think somehow, down in my bones, I've always known it. Then I had, after I finished my school in Bornholm, I went to go to the university in Copenhagen, and for I lived there for about 15 years, and then I began to have this longing for coming back to Bornholm, and I had a feeling that there might be something to explore. I don't know, it's a kind of intuition. So, yes, I went back to Bornholm.
And so you were drawn back by the energy of the place. Would you say that Bornholm is considered to be a sacred island that has a special kind of, you know, force, dragon force moving through it?
I'm quite sure that this is the case. I think it comes from, somehow it comes from the rocks. You know, that the rocks are up in the surface in this island. There is some kind of radiation coming from these rocks. I'm absolutely certain about that. So, but of course, it's not things that you can sort of everybody can feel. And somehow it creates a certain kind of mood when you live there.
Well, do you know of any other spiritual or mystical groups like the Templars that have lived on Bornholm and perhaps, you know, tapped into that energy source for their spiritual work?
No, I don't know that. But one thing which is remarkable is that when you talk about Christianity, now Denmark is a nation where Christianity is part of the state, so it's part of the foundation of the country. And in Bornholm, you have, I think, within this relatively little area, I think you have a large variety of Christian organization. I don't think you find such a large variety of Christianity within the same sort of square kilometers anywhere else, neither in Denmark nor, I think, anywhere else in the world, actually.
Well, I assume that you were brought up Christian then. That seems to be the prevailing religion on the island. Did you attend one of these unique style churches when you were growing up?
No. I'm growing up as a Christian, as you say, but I don't think I have any. I didn't have any. So my parents wasn't very particularly Christian in that regards, and no, I don't have any particular thought of Christianity that I'm brought up with. On the contrary, I have my own Christianity, so to say.
Okay, so you didn't actually enter these churches and experience their energy until a little bit later on in life.
No, well, the thing is that early I was very interested in alchemy, and alchemy is very close related to Christianity, as well, of course, to many other religions. But you find the symbols in the Bible very, very related to alchemy, and so I always thought that it cannot be that if it is possible to receive something, to end up with something in alchemy, that it is only for those people living in, say, New York or in one of the great capitals. The secrets must be everywhere. So it's just necessarily to go back and look for where it is in your place.
Well, these 15 churches that you refer to in your book, have they been used throughout history for anything else other than churches? Have they been used as a gathering place for alchemists or spiritual groups?
Well, I think that the kind of Christianity that was at the time when these churches were built were in many aspects very close to the philosophy behind alchemy. And those who built them, I think, had a profound knowledge of that. But also, again, they were churches in a very specific way because, as you know, the round churches have three floors. And the upper floor were used as astronomical observation towers. And this is very profound in the early Christianity because everything, every what you say, when you have Christmas and you have Easter and all these kind of events, is very, very closely related to a specific thought that has to do with the positions of the sun.
Right, and so they were the Templars that built these churches, obviously they were trying to generate a certain kind of an alchemical energy. They aligned them with the solstices or the equinoxes. They created them in the Gothic style, which naturally generates a lot of power. I would assume that they were probably also built on top of vortexes. Have you found that to be true?
Yes, I think there is something that could actually point in that direction. There is, under the Church of Österlass, some underground structure, which could mean that there has been some holy thing under there before. So the knowledge that that actually is connected to the churches probably go much, much further back in time. But again, also, I have to emphasize that that it is also science. The astronomical observations that was performed with these churches had also a very specific scientific purpose.
Do you think that maybe they did some kind of special ceremony or initiations or something along that line during the solstices and equinoxes in these churches?
Oh, yeah, I'm absolutely certain that they did. Well, if I could just can go very briefly into the connection between astronomy and Christianity.
Sure.
It is like this, that when Jesus was, what do you call that, when he was created, so to say, when he was, what is the English word for the first sort of creation? I missed the word. Wow. When he was, well, you have it in the Bible when Maria was told that she was with a child. Are you there, Mark?
Yes, yes, I'm right there with you.
Okay. Now, when she was told is it conception? He was concepted, is it? Is that it? Is that the word?
Conceived, yes.
Conceived. All right. Now, this is supposed in the old days to be at the time when the universe was born, and now the universe was born at the time when day and night are equal length, which means the spring equinox. Because mm-hmm. after that, the light begins to take over, and the day begins to be longer. And that's, if you go back to the Book of Moses and the creation, you will see that this is how God says that He put this limit between darkness and light. And of course, we're talking about the spiritual darkness here, but the light of
right.
the sun becomes a symbol of that.
Right.
So Jesus was conceived here at that very moment when we have the equinox, spring equinox, and then the days, the light takes over, and then of course 9 months later he is born, and that then of course will be again at the time when the lights come back, because he was born when we have the change that the lights take over again at Christmas time. So,
mm-hmm.
so these two points are very, very important to celebrate in Christianity. And then, of course, in the middle, we have the birth of St. John, because he is now connected to the very day when the light is on its summit. So the whole Christian church has its holy days connected to this thing.
Right. Exactly. Right. Well, that's a interesting way of putting it. Thank you, Erling. Well, one thing that really intrigues me, and I know you've done a lot of research on this, is how the Templars actually ended up on Bornholm, of all places. Can you go into some of that history?
Yeah, well, I think that there might have been a connection. Well, first of all, you have to see that the Templars are founded by the Burgundian families. First of all, when the First Crusade was announced, it was by Urban II, who was out of the Burgundian noble families. And I think that they had their special agenda. They actually did the whole Crusades in order to have political control over Jerusalem. So it was a part of a sort of secret agenda when they made the crusade. And Urban II was out of the nobility of Burgundy, and then when they then announced the first king of Jerusalem, Godfrey of Bouillon, he was also one of the noble families of Burgundy. Unfortunately, the Pope died just 1 month after they conquered Jerusalem, so they couldn't go on with their plans. I believe their plans was that they wanted the political control because that was something very important that they had to bring home from Jerusalem. So they had to wait until they had another Pope, which was out of the Burgundian families, and that was Callistus. And when he was a Pope, that was the founding of the Knights Templar, and they were nine members of the Templars, and they were all out of the Burgundian families. So all this is connected strongly to Burgundy and the Burgundian family. And Bornholm was before a Burgundian island. The Burgundians had their home there, and probably also they had a king here on Bornholm for a very long period. So there was a profound understanding in the Burgundian families for this island. They knew things about this island.
Right. And so that's really at the root of it, is the Burgundian connection. Well, they I guess according to your book, there was a crusade that occurred up in that area, and that's when perhaps the Cistercians and the Templars themselves, really colonized the area.
Yeah, well, there is an archbishop in Denmark called Eskil at this time, and he is a very, very close friend to Bernard of Clairvaux. And he visited Bernard in 1142, and Bernard died in 1143, and he came back in 1143. And I think that he and Bernhard in 52 had a conversation which meant that Bornholm should be used for something important after his death. Because I think Bernhard, you remember Bernhard of Clairvaux, he was the protector of the Knights Templar.
Right.
And after his death, they didn't have any protector. So it was very important for them to, if they had any sort of items that they brought from Jerusalem, it was very important for them then to find new hiding places. And I think that the new Grand Master of the Knights Templar, Bertrand de Blanchefort, who was appointed exactly at this time in 1153, that his task was to find new hiding places, and that's why Eskil came back to the castle of Clairvaux. And he was staying there for 3 years in this period. And after that period, actually, he stayed more down there, longer down there than he did in his homeland. And he is also buried down there. So there's a very strong connection between the Abbey of Clairvaux and the Archbishop Eskil from Denmark. And Eskil had Bornholm as a specific gift from the Danish king. So he had actually sort of sovereignty over the island.
Interesting. Well, the Templars were stationed up there for quite a while, it appears. Were they forced to flee from Bornholm at the same time that they were arrested in France?
Well, I think that... you know that they were abandoned from the church. Actually, we are approaching now the 700 years anniversary of that. In 1314, in March, actually. So it's coming up soon now. When they were eliminated. And I think the reason they were that was because that they were working closely with intellectuals from the Muslim Spain. They were actually doing a large-scale scientific experiment that was to tell them the exact shape of the Earth. Now, they knew, of course, that it was round, but the judge said that it was something that was laying immobile in the middle of the universe, and it was the shape of a sphere. But the question was it a perfect sphere? And you can make astronomical observations to see whether this sphere was perfect or not. And this was very important if they wanted to calculate the size of the sphere, which was very important for these people in those days because they were trading very much and they would like to know how far to go to India, for instance, if they wanted to sail there and so on and so forth. So this was very important both for the Islamic people and for the Christian. And in order to do that, you need observatories north of 45 degrees. And the Muslim didn't have anything north of that, but the Christian had. So they had the same interest in having observations, for instance, on an island like Bornholm.
Well, Erlang, you're the one that's responsible for doing most of the or plotting most of the ley lines, I assume, or a good portion of them, and what you've been able to come up with is that the churches seem to be set in a configuration like a pentagram. Is that right?
Well, it's not just a pentagram. It's actually more a hexagram, but there is also a pentagram involved in it. But basically, it's an hexagram. So it's hexagonal geometry that connects the four round churches. Now I have found out that this then explained actually the purpose, because the four round churches, the upper floor of that was an observatory. And when you connect observatories in such a way that you know their relation in the direction east, west, north, south, then you can make very specific astronomical observations that can tell you something about the shape of the Earth. So it has a scientific purpose. But of course, also, I think that at the same time also had a religious purpose, so to say that they are using this symbolism, which is connected to the pentagram and to the hexagram, but at the same time also they are very important in relation to this experiment that I'm sure now is the real reason why the church abandoned them and took all the archives. This is the interesting thing. We don't have any. Although we are in historical time, we have not a single document that tells us who built the churches of Bornholm, why, at what time, and what was the purpose. Nothing. There's nothing there. And I'm sure that this has to do with what the church did when they abandoned the Knights Templar. They took their archives. They took all, everything that was written.
But you think maybe there could be some documents that perhaps are still hidden on the island?
No, but I think there could be documents hidden in the Vatican Library. I'm actually quite sure that that is the case, because I don't think they destroyed it. They just took it and hide it away.
Okay.
So I was seriously hope that they will come up with it, because what I think was that at this time we had actually the Renaissance. It is very equal to the Renaissance that came 400 years later, what we can call the Italian Renaissance, which actually led up to all the understanding and science we have today. But they began that by the end of the 12th century. But then there the church then put a lead on it. So I think that this is very important for us to understand the way that you can be misled by people who want the power through religion.
Well, getting back to the ley lines just for a moment, I assume that the Templars would have been aware of the ley line configurations and created their churches or built their churches right over them and on the vortexes. Now, so if that's the case and the churches create this hexagram or this pentagram, that means that the natural ley line patterns create a pentagram or hexagram, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think that when we look at space as such, it's interesting because there is space is ruled by certain geometrical, it's kind of like gravity or anything else. There is a sort of profound rules that guides the space, so that everything that sort of materialize in space will then try to live up to this kind of rule. So that, well, you cannot have anything materializing in space which is perfect. I mean, you can't have a perfect circle, you can't have a perfect hexagram, and so on. But philosophically, it exists because this is the basic rule of space. And for that reason, it is, of course, important to try to also emphasize it on Earth, for instance.
Well, perhaps by having a natural ley line configuration in the shape of a pentagram, perhaps that's testimony that there really is, that this we're talking about an island that really is a vortex which has a natural spiraling energy moving through it. According to the golden mean proportion, which the five-pointed star is based upon. So maybe this is an indication that, yes, this really is a vortexual island here.
Yeah, I think so. But then again, you have to understand that the island of Wono before had over 4,000 standing stones. Now there is just, I think, about 50 or something left of them. But there were people aware of how to stimulate this kind of, what you say, vortex or whatever, how you could stimulate that. And they did that by, for instance, by putting up standing stones in certain patterns. Now, unfortunately, we can't see that patterns anymore because there's so little left of the stones that it's not possible to find it. But the churches still indicate the overall pattern of these.
Well, obviously the ancients knew that this was a very special sacred island and had special energy, or that's why they erected all these standing stones.
Yes.
I'm fascinated about the Bornholm Rennes-Le-Château connection. When exactly did you meet up with Henry Lincoln and start comparing notes with him?
Well, this was because I had found this geometrical pattern between the churches, and I found that it was very accurate. Actually, later I found it even much more accurate than I thought in those days. Today I can see that it's accurate down to 1/100 of a degree. But even so, I found out in those days that it was so accurate that you couldn't imagine that people on Bornholm would know how to build churches like that. So I began to wonder who could have done it. And then, since I don't think that little green men from Mars came down to the Earth and told us how to do things, but this is also not necessarily, because the knowledge of doing it is here on Earth at that time and has been for several thousand years before that. But it was connected, of course, to civilizations in the eastern end of the Mediterranean. So I began to think, could there have been a connection at this time between this area and that area? And then the Crusades, of course, came into the picture. And after studying that again, I then more and more was convinced that it must have had something to do with the Knights Templar. And then I began to remember that I have seen the BBC broadcast that Henry made about this very strange story about the priest down in Rennes-Le-Château, and there was strong connections to Templars in that story. And for me, it was important to think, to see if there could be another place where the Templars might have done the same sort of pattern. So I called Henry. This was not easy, but I found his number eventually, and I called him and I said, I think that you should try to see if there could be a connection geometrically between the churches down there in the area around the chateau. Then there was some kind of a long pause, and then he said, have you read my book? And I said, yes, yes, of course, because I thought he meant Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which I, of course, have studied with great interest and very closely. But no, he didn't mean that, because in the same week that I called him, he had just published the book The Holy Place, in which he explained that there is a geometrical pattern between the churches down there in Rennes-le-Château. So, of course, he then said, we will have to meet, we will have to talk. And since I am also a director of documentaries, we then decided, I met him in Paris, actually, because his book was coming out in Paris the following week. So we met there, and we compared the geometry I found with the geometry he had found, and we could see that there was a connection. And then we decided that we had to do a documentary about this. So this is how the work between me and Henry started, and it has been going on since then.
Well, I'm sure that he's been up to Bornholm probably more than once during this time period. Yeah. Well, it really amazes me that you grew up in an island that was covered over with apparently Templar-built structures, and nobody seemed to have any clue that they were built by the Templars. And that's really amazes me. It seemed like it should have been some history.
Well, this is not quite true, Mark, because I didn't know that when I was actually having this idea that they could have been made by the Templars. But there was an art historian who, about 5-6 years prior to my hypothesis, actually had published an article where she compared the architecture of the round churches of Bornholm with the architecture of the Knights Templar churches. Now, the thing is that the round churches of Bornholm is called, in circles of historians and archaeologists, is called the Bornholm type, because you don't have anywhere else in Scandinavia a round church with this kind of specific architecture, and you have four on Bornholm. So they are called the Bornholm type. And it has, of course, been believed that they were developed by the people of Bornholm. But this art historian, Mette Weber, she published an article where she then documented that this was exactly Templar design. This was the same design that you can find in Templar churches. So she was there before me.
I see. Okay. Well, besides the design, this Gothic design, that on Bornholm of these churches that you can find in other places in Europe of Templar-built structures. Were there other indications that the Templars had built these structures? Did they leave behind any special symbols, for example?
Well, not exactly. You do find, though, the specific Templar crosses more than one place is connected to the churches. So there is small signs, but as again, you don't have any documents saying it, and you don't find any sort of documentation that you can rely on. Of course, there has also been strong critics that I say that they could have been made by the Templars, because they say there hasn't been a single Templar in Denmark nor in Bornholm, because we don't have any documents proving that. But actually, this is not quite so, because when the Pope dissolved the Templar Order, he then decided that their properties should go to the Order of Saint John, and then he sent out a letter, and this, of course, you can see this letter that he sent out to the bishops, saying that they should see to that the Templar properties was given to St. John. Now, he didn't send that out to every bishop within the Christianity. He only sent them out to those that he knew had properties. And out of the 8 bishops in Denmark at that time, only 3 bishops got this letter. And one of them was the Archbishop of Lund, where Bornholm belonged to. So you can say there is no directly proof, but on the other hand, there must have been Templar property in Denmark.
Well, to get back to the Rennes-le-Château Bornholm connection just for a moment, I was fascinated in your book where you talk about on Bornholm that there was discovered these golden sheets that were stamped with figures that appear to be the Merovingian kings. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Yes, this is what I'm saying, that the Bornholm was previously called the Burgundian island, and we have historians who, in those days, Orosius, for instance, who writes that this was the originally homeland of the Burgundians. Now, we have then, on a little field, very little field, in Bornholm, we have found over 3,000 of these small gold plates. They're only about 2.5 centimeter high, and very, very thin gold plates, and they are stamped out. But one of the figures that goes again most is a person with a fair coat and a long stick in his hand, sometimes even a ball, and he has a long hair, and the historian says that these are Merovingian kings. So now, of course, you can begin to wonder, why do we have such a large number of pictures of Merovingian kings?
Right.
Now, these are dated back to around 7th century, 650, something like that. And this was very closely after that Clovis, the Merovingian king, married Clotilde, the Burgundian princess, and then they put these two countries together. So I believe that they had their family, because they are found where we know that there was a king's yard. So this was the king of Bornholm, and he was, I believe, out of the Burgundian family, and this is why we have this portrait of Merovingian kings connected to this.
But 3,000 of them, don't you think that's pretty amazing,
yeah,
that there'd be that many of them?
Yeah. I mean, prior to that, that they discovered this one, they had found under 100... These type of tokens, so to say, they are specifically things that you find in the Scandinavian countries. But prior to this, they have only found this kind of things less than 100 of different places. And now suddenly it appears that on a very little small field where the king's yard used to be, there is over 3,000.
Well, do you have a museum on Bornholm now where you're displaying what you found in these excavations?
Yeah, fortunately, they still have them at the Bornholm Museum, because many of the more important things from the Bornholm archaeology is exhibited at the National Museum in Copenhagen. But I think for the moment they are still there in Bornholm. You can see them there.
Well, the people living on Bornholm, do they welcome tourists? Is tourism is that part of what really supports the island?
Yes, it has always been, because the island is incredibly beautiful, and it's also so that you can see every nature that you find in Scandinavia. I mean, from the white sandy beaches to the high cliffs of granite, they're all there in this very little area of Bornholm. So, yes, Bornholm has a lot of tourists coming there for its beauty.
Well, I assume since you've made your discoveries, there's probably a lot of Templars or Templar-related people that are going up there now and checking out the place, checking out the churches, and maybe trying to see if they can make some discovery themselves.
Yes, that's true. And we also have an institution called the Middle Age Center of Bornholm, where people dress out that they do in the Middle Age, and tourists come there. And they have now launched a treasure hunt, so that you can actually be part of a treasure hunt, and then you can find the manuscript of Eskil. This is, of course, fiction, but this is a fiction I made for them. So it's divided into 24 pieces, and you have then to follow directions on this treasure hunt, and you can find each piece in different places and eventually put them together. And then you have something which is, of course, fantasy, but it's based on historical facts. And people are doing that. They launched it this year, and it will again come up next year.
Well, in regards to treasure, I'm sure you have a lot of Templar treasure hunters that are up there trying to find the old hidden Templar treasure, just like they're down swarming around the Remnant Chateau area.
Yeah. Well, there are. I should say there is, of course, coming more and more people in this connection. But I also think that this is what I just said about the very reason why they made these churches and why they put them into this geometrical pattern, because it has to do with science, and that again is very, very important. Because I mean, if the church hadn't put a lead on it in those days, and if we take we started after we actually were able to say yes, the sun is the center of the universe, like Copernicus said, and so Galileo Galilei was right, and it wasn't necessarily for you to burn his books, which they did actually for 214 years after that he made this hypothesis. But if the church hadn't stopped that in the 11th century, in the 12th century, we would have been walking on the moon probably in 1569 instead of 1969. So this is very important for us to understand the impact of how religion can put you back, so to say.
Well, I'm looking at the cover of your book right now, The Templar's Secret Island, and what predominates in terms of these ley lines on Bornholm is the downward pointing pentagram. And I think it's quite interesting. I mean, in comparison to David Wood's work down in the Remnant Chateau area, where he surveyed a pentagram with an upward moving pentagram. So Bornholm is a downward pentagram. Remnant Chateau is an upward pointing pentagram. What do you make of that? Anything special?
No, but there's one thing that that actually is missing on the original book here, because later it has been discovered that the geometry is very, very accurately oriented towards the north. I didn't know that at that time, because I was looking at a map actually, which where all the lines to north was parallel, so I didn't see how accurately the whole design is oriented towards north. But this orientation is actually a very important key to understand it, because this is again has to do with the scientific experiment. So I think you will have to look at an updated version that Henry and I did not so many years ago, where you have an extra number of pages put into the book at the end where we explain this.
Well, I thought when I looked at your drawing on the cover of your book, that what stood out for me was the inverted five-pointed star, because in my tradition, or a lot of people's tradition, it's the symbol, it's the Luciferian symbol, or associated with darkness and destruction, and ultimately alchemy. And so it almost would reveal that sooner or later this island would be a headquarters of alchemical work or alchemical research. So anyway, that's my two cents. I'm throwing it to the pot.
It's very important to understand that this is a combination of this. You cannot divide science from philosophy, and you cannot divide philosophy from religion. So everything is actually part of alchemy. In alchemy, it's very important, everything, every little sort of thing in this fits together. So so there is no contradiction in saying that you have a religious symbol, which is a pentagon or the hexagon, and at the same time you have a scientific experiment where it actually is very good to have these kind of accurate understanding of the relation between the churches in relation to the North, because then you can do some very important experiments.
So, well, conceivably, the Templars could have used these buildings, these what are used as churches now, could have been used by the Templars as maybe for their alchemy or for some more kind of mystical, esoteric work than they're used for now.
Yes, it could be used for that at the same time. And you can also see it because, for instance, the rising of the sun of the summer solstices and the winter solstices is very emphasized in the church. And actually, the winter solstices, which is the most important, is like a glowing sword going right through the church. It comes from a little opening you have, and then there is a beam going through the all the way through the church. So there is an opening. You know, the central pillar is hollow, and then there is an opening in the wall, outer wall. Then there is an opening in the central pillar at the one wall. Then there is an opening again at the other wall, so that you have this beam going right through the church, just for a few seconds on that very particular morning. Of the rising of the midsummer and the midwinter solstices sun. It's very. I can tell you, Mark. It's very. You should go there. You should see it because it's so fascinating. Because it's absolutely dark when you are in the church. You can see nothing, and then suddenly you see this glowing like a laser beam going through the.
Well, I'm hoping to go to Bornholm next year or the year after. Bring with me our members of our Templar order and perhaps have a Templar gathering or ceremony there. I mean, how do the locals feel about that, people coming in, Templars coming in from the outside and conducting ceremonies on their island?
You could have problems because the community of the church, those who actually own the church, so to say, they are looking upon this with suspicion. So, yeah.
Right. So that could be a bit of an obstacle, it sounds like.
It could be, but on the other hand, I mean, we can talk about it and we can see if we can find solutions.
Well, I'm surprised that other Templar groups or sects haven't tried to do the same thing, go up there and conduct special ceremonies, considering this was a special headquarters of the Knight Templars in ancient times.
Yeah.
So you're not aware of any
but
group
then
that
again,
have,
Mark, also to, you have, but you have also to consider that I don't think that they actually, I mean, they probably used that for very rare occasions, like the sort of special celebrations of the winter solstices. But I don't think they ever lived there as such. They built this as a very important part of an astronomical experiment that actually I think was going through Europe and which were, you know, that they were fraternizing with the enemy. This is because they worked together with scientists from the Arabian world or from the Islamic mm-hmm. world in Spain. That's because they were several hundred years ahead of the scientists in the Christian Church at that time. They use that for sort of in a sort of way to worship God together. I mean, it's not specifically because it's Christian. They were enemies, you know, deadly enemies, these people considered to be. But those people who had the intelligence, they found each other in this area. And that was the thorn in the flesh for the church.
So what you're saying is you don't believe that the Templars actually lived on the island, so it sounds like specially chosen Templars were stationed there to do special kind of astronomical work or whatever in these structures?
Yes, I'm set.
Oh, very fascinating, fascinating. Well, I'm definitely interested in going, and I'm sure everybody listening in this interview is interested in going, so maybe we'll help to increase the tourist trade. And
you will find that they are equipped for taking tourists. Very good hotels and very nice people, and speaking English, all of them. And Yes. You will be very welcome.
Okay. Are you actually giving tours there yourself, or?
Well, sometimes, I mean, but this is not very much, but if people approach me and ask me to do it, I'm, of course, willing to do it, yes.
Okay. Well, consider yourself asked.
Okay.
When I get there, you're definitely going to be the guide of choice for me and the Templars I'll bring with me, so... I guess you're probably pretty busy, though. What's your current research?
There will be a new book because now I think I found, as I told you, that there is also science connected to it, and this can be proved. And the accuracy of the geometry is so amazing, you wouldn't believe it. It's better than, it's down to 100th degree. And this is, of course, also necessarily when you want to do the measurement for this kind of purpose that I will explain that they did. And then again, also, I would like to have more evidence because I think, you know, the first astronomical observatory built in Europe was the Giralda. This is we know that it's still there. It's a bell tower to the Cathedral of Sevilla. But the cathedral was before a mosque, so it was a sort of minaret, or what do you call it, for mm-hmm. the mosque. But it was at the same time an astronomical observatory. So the Islam built the first astronomical observatories in Europe, so it was not in Christian Europe. According to our history, we don't have astronomical observatories in Christian Europe until we are way up in the 16th century. But I am quite sure now that these churches in Bornholm are astronomical observatories. They are from the 12th century, and they are at the same time as Giralda and those other astronomical observatories that the Islam scientists built in Spain, in the Iberian Peninsula.
So this is going to be in your next book?
This is going to be in my next book, yes. And since people have said that what I have come up with is a coincidence, I think I will call my book the Island of the Marvelous Coincidences.
Okay, well, that'll stand out for sure. So when do you think your next book's going to be coming out?
Well, what I had hoped was that I could do it when we have the 700 years anniversary of the abandonment of the Knights Templar, which is in March next year. I'm not quite sure I will be that, but at least it will be in 2012.
Excellent. Well, can people buy your books on your website, or do they need to go to Amazon or to another
website? Well, I have only one in English for the moment, The Templar Secret Island, and that you'll have to go to Amazon to buy. But if you can also download two of my books in Danish. So if some of your listeners are speaking Danish, they can do that, and they can find it on the internet. There is electronic edition of two of my books.
Well, I think there will be at least one that's listening that speaks Danish, and he's our squire, Martin Poulsen, who was able to arrange this interview. And so, hello, Martin. I imagine you're out there listening, and thank you for your work. Do you plan to translate these other books into English at any time?
Yes, I do so, certainly. I hope, of course, that my new book at least will be, I'm quite sure that will be in English at some point. Also, my website, which is now in Danish, I'm working on it. I have been working on it for about 2-3 months, a new website where I explain very much of my new findings. And it is still working, I'm still working on it in Danish, but eventually I think... Before January, it will be in English as well, and it's called Merling.dk.
Okay, did I spell it right at the beginning of the show?
I couldn't hear you because the phone fell
off. Oh, right. Well, it's I spell it Merling.dk. Is that right?
No. It's just Merling. DK.
Okay, great, great. I'm glad I asked. Okay, well, I'm sure a lot of us are going to be checking out your website very soon. Are you? Do you have any plans to speak at any conferences, upcoming conferences, or anything in the near future?
Not in the near future, no. No, right now I'm actually working very hard by making my website finished. I think people can actually use Google Translator in order to have a general idea of what is in there until I can have it translated. But it takes up all my time for the moment to finish that.
And so you are currently spending most of your time on the island?
No, I moved to Copenhagen 2 years ago, so I'm living in Copenhagen now.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But I'm still going back to Ireland. My old mother, who will be 90 next year, is still living on the island. So yes,
I do go there
from time to time.
Oh, good. Well, I'd like to visit you in Copenhagen too. That's one of my favorite cities, and
I think I'm a quarter Danish.
And so I have relatives in Aalborg, but I have passed through Copenhagen. I love that city.
Okay. I was actually baptized in Budolfi Church in Aalborg.
No kidding. small world, as they say, right?
Yeah.
Well, one way or the other, I look forward to meeting with you, and I'm hoping that with Martin's help, that we can set up some kind of event on Bornholm, probably not next year, probably 2013, and certainly would like to have you involved with that. So so you'll be hearing from me.
Okay.
And I really appreciate you coming on the show today. It's a fascinating interview, and I'm sure everyone's very, very intrigued with Bornholm now, and they're all going to rush out and get your book. Because I definitely encourage everyone to do that, because there's a lot in the book that was not covered today during the interview.
Yeah.
So again,
it has been a pleasure, Mark, for me also to have this opportunity to explain a little about my thoughts and research. So thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Very welcome. And again, thank you so much for coming on today, Erling. And maybe we'll have you on in the future sometime and hear more about your research.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, take care. Take care.
The same to you and to all your listeners.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that's today's show, and we'll be back in a couple weeks. I'm hoping that I can get a Uzedi leader, a Uzedi holy man, to come on. We can talk to him from Iraq. Uzedis are having a difficult time. Well, they have had a difficult time there for ages, but it's about to get a lot worse if there is the troop withdrawal that occurs at the end of this year, where our U.S. troops have completely leave Iraq, because the Yazidis count on our troops to protect them, basically. And once our troops are gone, it could be the death knell for the Yazidis. And so the leaders of the Yazidis are pleading for help from whatever source that they can get it. And I've been encouraging people to write to their senators and representatives and presidents or whatever, and ask them if there's some way that we can extend the withdrawal deadline. And also, it would be nice if there could be an ongoing kind of peacekeeping force in Iraq to protect the Yazidis and the other minorities. And if you go to www.yaziditruth.org, there's a form letter that you can download and then adapt it to your needs and send it off to your senator or representative. In fact, President Obama has a website where you can email to him, email messages to him, and which I've done as well. So there are a number of options that you can follow up on. But they're in desperate need, and we're going to hear from a Yazidi leader exactly what's going on and what needs to happen right now. But we'll also hear about their amazing history that's like none other. And they know things, they have secrets, they have mysteries that nobody else in the world has. So you're not going to want to miss that program. And while it's not set in stone, we're going to get them on, but I'm certainly hoping that we will. So that's the show for today. And as always, if you're looking for the Holy Grail, we all are, turn your focus inwards, and you're going to find it right in your own heart. Bye for now.